the grade schools as well. And that is true, and I totally agree with that. But there's another stumbling block for many young people, and that is the injustices that they see in our world. And they wonder how God can allow these injustices to continue. When we consider the condition of our world, the oppression, the suffering, the injustice, it can leave not just young people feeling overwhelmed and confused and full of despair. It can trouble all of us. It can trouble many of you who have struggled and wonder why the world is in the condition that it's in. What do you struggle with? What have you seen that troubles you and makes you wonder why God allows those things to happen? Well, this morning we want to look at Psalm 73 because that's the condition of the psalmist. He's concerned about all the injustice that he sees in the world. This is a psalm of Asaph, and I'm sure that it's a psalm that you have heard preached on many times in the course of your life, especially if you're as old as I am. So we want to look at it from a little different perspective this morning. Asaph makes, I think, a very effective use of repetition in this psalm. It's a repetition in which there is a contrast that he develops. So we want to look at that literary device that he uses and see how that can help us, how it can encourage us and strengthen our hearts as we see all the injustices in our world around us. So the first one I want to point out to you is that there are two kinds of hearts. And when I talk about heart, or as the psalmist uses the term heart, he's talking about our innermost being, our true self. Who you really are comes from your heart. The first heart that we notice is there in chapter Psalm 73, verse 1, and that is the pure heart. God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. He's giving us his conclusion at the beginning, and I don't want to look at the conclusion too much yet, but I want to latch on to that phrase, pure heart. What's a pure heart? Well, if a pure heart means a perfect heart, a sinless heart, there aren't too many of those around. In fact, I don't know of any. Not among mortals. But as we, and this is a message in itself, so you can study it out on your own, but I'll suggest my conclusion from studying the scriptures. What the pure heart is a heart loyal to God. It is a heart devoted to God. Does not set up idols. Israel, as a covenant people of God, were expected to be loyal to God, even as God was loyal to them. And if you are loyal to God, then you will seek to obey Him. You will want to do what pleases Him. Keeping His law, acting justly towards your fellow man. But you don't measure up. You don't do that perfectly. And so those who have a pure heart are constantly seeking to cleanse their hearts. They are penitent when they do wrong. They acknowledge it when they are confronted with the wrong that they are doing. They seek forgiveness and cleansing. Is that the heart that you brought to the communion service? That's what God expects of us. Not perfection. We all fall short, but in a pure heart, He is number one, and He's the one that we're seeking to serve. There's the pure heart, and that's in contrast to the heart that we find in verse 7, talking about the wicked. Their eyes swell out through fatness. their hearts overflow with follies. I call this the evil scheming heart. And why is that? Well, there's an unusual word that's used here. And it's a word because it is unusual. The translators trip over themselves trying to figure out what the best way to translate it is. So the ESV translates it, it's a heart that overflows with follies. Or the NIV says, refers to it as the evil conceits of their minds. The NASB might be closest when it talks about the imagination of their hearts run riot. Because the word that's used is the word that means imagination. But what are these evil people imagining? They're imagining evil. Can I paraphrase it something like this? They do whatever evil they think of. And that's the psalmist's problem. Whatever they can imagine, whatever evil they can think of, they do it, and they seem to be getting away with it. The Expositor's Bible Commentary explains it this way: the hearts of the wicked are full of imaginations or schemings by which they seem to succeed and prosper. They make their plans, and it seems to work for them. They get richer and more powerful. Well, let's look at that heart. If you look through this section and see the characteristics of these people with wicked hearts, I think that we can summarize it in three ways. First, we see that this evil, scheming heart is proud or arrogant. Look at that in verse 3. They're arrogant. Verse 6, their pride. And then look at the picture. The author gives us a picture of what their pride is like. There in verse 6, he says, therefore, pride is their necklace. What a picture. What is a necklace? It's something that you think is beautiful and you put it on for an adornment. And here are these characters. They're not ashamed of their pride. They hang it around their neck. Look at me! They're proud of their pride. And then a second characteristic of them is that they are violent and oppressive. Verse 6, therefore pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Verse 8, they scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They have power, and they are characterized by violence and oppression. They have power, and they abuse their power. That never happens today, does it? Are there people in power who abuse their power and seem to get away with it? But look at the picture that he gives us of this violence and oppression. There in verse 6, he says they put on violence as a garment. Incredible pictures. I wake up in the morning, and I don't know about you, but I just put on normal clothes. But these guys, as they're getting ready to start their day, they put on violence as a garment. They put it on, and now they're ready to do battle. Bring it on. They're looking for a fight. They've got the power. They're not afraid of anybody, and they'll take on anybody who disagrees with them. And then the third characteristic of these with the evil, scheming hearts, they are verbally abusive. Verse 8, they scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. Verse 9, they set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. They set their mouths against man and they set their mouths against God. They blaspheme God. They slander men. They don't care what they say or who they hurt or the damage they cause and the things they say. Did you see the picture there? Asaph, he thinks in pictures. And so his picture for this abusive tongue, their tongue struts through the earth. Can you picture that in your mind? There's a tongue strutting through the earth. I'm going to say whatever I want to say. I'll say it to you. I'll say it to your face. I'll say it to God. A proud tongue. No shame. Pure heart. And then the evil scheming heart. Have you ever seen that heart? The evil scheming heart. Was that something unique in Asaph's day? Do you see this kind of a heart? Proud, oppressive, verbally abusive. Do you ever see that in the media? How about in government? You've never seen a politician with this kind of a heart, have you? How about in business? Heads of these enormous, mega corporations. You never see it in the entertainment industry, do you? And of course, you never see such things on the internet and any of the things that people post. Everybody speaks humbly and gently and kindly on the internet, don't they? Nobody would be abusive on the internet. Just as true today as it's always been. Two kinds of hearts, the pure heart and the evil scheming heart. The psalmist is struggling with that. What kind of heart do you have? What kind of heart are you seeking to have? But we move on from the two hearts to two situations regarding plagues. And this word that's used is not translated plagues in our text in the ESV, but it could have been. Notice the first situation involving plagues there in verse 5. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not plagued or stricken like the rest of mankind. It's the same word that's translated plagues in other places in the Bible. For instance, in Exodus, where God says, I'm about to bring the 10th, the final plague on Egypt, the death of the firstborn. That's the word that we have here. So this guy with the evil scheming tongue, what's his experience of plagues? What plagues does he have? Well, in Asaph's mind at this point, what's driving him crazy is that he has no plagues. He seems to be doing just fine. Look at him in verse 3. He's prosperous. And as if that's not bad enough, in verse 12, he's not only prosperous, but he just gets richer and richer. You see, our time is not a unique time. Maybe it's gotten this way more and more, but it has always been true that it is, if you are rich, it's easier to get richer than it is for a poor man or woman to become wealthy. It is still true that wealth begets wealth. If nothing else, you who are multimillionaires out there, some of you can make more off of your investments, just your interest, without lifting a hand to do a moment's work. You can make more money on those investments than some laborers can make working 50 hours a week. The psalmist says they just get richer and richer. And it just doesn't seem right to him. They have prosperity. They have health in verse 4. There are no pangs until death. Seems to be the idea that's present there according to the commentaries. They're well fed, according to verse 4. Verse 7, they're so well fed, their eyes are puffing out with fatness. On top of that, they're popular. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. Whoa, that must be successful. These people that can seem so obnoxious still can attract others to them because people like to be around successful people. And, you know, would you rather be the friend of a rich man or the friend of a poor man? So they're popular. People are drawn to success. They're drawn to successful people. In verse 11, they seem to be unaccountable. They don't have to answer to anybody. Untouchable. They're rich. They're powerful. They're popular. Verse 11, and they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Not even God can do anything. Does he know? Does he do anything? Well, that's his situation regarding plagues, or so it seems to the psalmist as he's going through this time of struggle. Well, how about the righteous? Look at verse 14. Look for our word plague again. Now this Asaph is talking about himself. For all the day long, I have been plagued and rebuked every morning. The wicked seems to have no plagues, and the righteous seems to be constantly bombarded with plagues, sufferings and troubles. And the wicked seem to be getting away with all kinds of things. But when I do something wrong, seems like God spanks me immediately. Rebukes me. Guilty conscience. Doesn't let me get away with it. And if I don't listen to that conscience, he'll deal with me more severely because he chastens every child that he receives unto himself. But God's chastening me all the time. God, what about him? He's getting away with murder over here. What's wrong with this picture? And the psalmist is almost driven to despair, and he comes back to his second use of the term heart in regard to himself in verse 13. All in vain have I kept my heart clean. What good is it to have a pure heart? Wash my hands in innocence. I'm the one who feels like he's getting plagued all the time. Now, I'm not a very good one to preach this because I haven't had a whole lot of plagues in my life. I have been so blessed. But you know, in the course of my ministry, I have certainly met plenty of people that are a lot like Asaph. They just seem to go from one heartache to another. Financial, health-wise, problems in their homes, and you just, God, why do they go through so much? I don't know. God knows. But isn't it so? You've seen people like that, and you've experienced it to some degree, that why is it that you're seeking to live for the Lord? Why aren't you the one that's wealthy and healthy and popular and all of these other things, when somebody else who has no interest in having a heart right with God, they seem to be doing so well? Have I cleansed my heart in vain? The psalmist is struggling. We go from the two kinds of hearts to the two situations regarding plagues. Now we move on to two slippery places. The first slippery place that we want to look at is where we may find ourselves if we are not careful. And that's where the psalmist was here in Psalm 73, verse 2. But as for me, My feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. He's known despair. It's just not fair. And he said, he's come to the point where he's questioned, have I cleansed my heart in vain? Is it really worth it to serve God with my whole heart? What am I getting out of this? God just or isn't he just? It's where we may find ourselves if we are not careful. But the psalmist, to his credit, didn't want to discourage anyone else. He's feeling ready to give up, but in verse 15, he doesn't want to discourage if anyone else. He says, if I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. So he just keeps his mouth shut. In danger of falling, in danger of slipping. But God in his mercy reached out to him and guided him. And we find that the psalmist went to the right place in the midst of his despair. Verse 16, but when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task, ready to give up. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. If he had just remained by himself with these things agitating inside of his mind, he might have slipped. But he went to the congregation of the people, the sanctuary of God, and there he found the help that he needed. I don't know what it was. I know what it is that helps me when I gather with the people of God. But if we can put ourselves in Asaph's day, remember what Asaph was? He was a musician at the temple. Maybe it was the music. When he went to the temple and gathered with the people of God and with the others in the choirs, praising God and remembering the character of God and remembering the faithfulness of God to his people in the past. Maybe that's what it was. It helped him to look at things more clearly. Maybe it was the offerings and the reminders of our covenant relationship with God and how he has been faithful to his people. Maybe it was being with the people of God and seeing that they're struggling too, and yet they're clinging to God and trusting that God will fulfill his promises. Reminders of the character of God, that he's good and holy and just. But it all began to come together for him, and the cloud that was causing him to not think clearly is lifted, and he begins to see more clearly. And what does he see? Well, he sees that he's not the only one that can slip. Because look at verse 18. As he's gone to the sanctuary of God, it says, then I discerned their end. In verse 18, truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. They may look like they're standing now. They may look impregnable now. If I said that right, can't be conquered. But it's just an illusion. Temporary condition. They are in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. That's where the wicked really are. He begins to see more clearly. And in doing so, look what happens. We'll see it later on. He strengthens his heart. So what do we get from this? What comfort can we get? Can I just, as we wrap up this morning, the wicked are in slippery places. I'm reminded of an article that was written by Andre Soule for World Magazine some time ago, in which she says, it's called Living in the Middle. And the subtitle is, Life is Not Always as It Seems. And she says, things appear the opposite of their true condition for a while. She says, there are people out there right now who think things are going well for them, when actually things are going quite badly for them, but they do not yet see it. It says, inner workings of what's going on in their hearts and in their lives is laying up a store of judgment for them. They don't realize that they are about to fall. And she says, on the other hand, conversely, people who think things are going badly for them, when actually things are going quite well, but they do not perceive it yet either. Because right now, things are all topsy-turvy. And then she gives us a good illustration, another picture. And she says it's like oil and water. You can take a jar and fill it with water, put half water and half oil, and you can shake it up. And it can seem like there's no difference between the oil and water, but it's just a matter of time. Just set it down, and very quickly, the oil and the water separate. They are not the same. Some are oil and some are water. So she says, so cheer up if your world is crashing at the moment and you are abiding in Christ's will. Tomorrow or next year, things will look completely different. So what do we do when we're discouraged by the injustice in this world and our feet are almost slipping? First, realize things are not always as they seem. We do not always see things as God sees them. Second, trust the timing and character of God. Look at it there in verse 20. Like a dream when one awakes, O God, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. Trust the timing and character of God. The holiness of God, the justice of God, demands that he ultimately judge the wicked and he bestows his favor on the righteous. Trust the timing and character of God. One of the advantages of being old is that I've lived long enough to see that God judges the wicked. I've seen despots rise and come to power and do all kinds of evil things, and then I've watched them fall. And even you young people have seen some of the dictators in the Middle East and in Libya. You've seen them in their fall, and great is their fall. God is in control, and he is able to judge the wicked. One of my earlier memories was feeling intimidated when a Khrushchev pounded on the podium with his shoe, and America, we will bury you. And where is Khrushchev today? You young people don't even know who he is. And where is the USSR today? It doesn't even exist anymore. God is able to raise up powers. He's able to bring them down. I don't know why he does it, when and how he does, but I trust God, and so I trust his character, and I trust his timing. And now is where I wish that I had another hour, because I'm about out of time, and I have something to say that is too important. And I want to make you think. And I'm not going to necessarily get you to agree with me this morning. you do agree with me that God does care about the injustices in this world. He cares about the poor, the oppressed, the sojourners, the widows, the orphans. I can take you from Genesis to Revelation and show you over and over again God's concern for social justice. He does care. In the Pentateuch, he gave laws to protect the oppressed. He gave laws to protect the poor. He gave laws to protect the sojourners in the land. He cared about all of those things. Just think, for example, what happened every 7 years for the poor? How would that go over today? How would you like that if every 7 years your credit card debts were canceled? Maybe the credit card companies would do things differently if that happened. God cares about poverty. He cares about injustice. And so he gave Israel just laws. Reread the Pentateuch and see God's just laws. Reread the history books and see God's justice. The book of Ruth, God cares about the aliens and the strangers. Esther, God cares about attempts to commit genocide. Put on the right lenses and see God's concern for social justice all through every portion of the Old Testament. In the Psalms, God cares about the poor. He hears their cries. Look at the prophets. God condemns the injustice. Have you read the book of Amos lately? He condemns all the social injustice in Israel and Judah and says God is going to bring them to account. All through the Old Testament, into the New Testament, from Matthew to Revelation, God cares about the oppressed and he expects us to care about them. One of the things we miss in the Beatitudes, most of our translations translate it, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after what? You're right. But did you know that that is the identical same word as the word for justice? We have made them two different words. But in Greek, and usually in Hebrew, they're the same word. How would that change your perspective if you translated it, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after justice? But you see, in the Hebrew mind, because and the Greek mind as well, because they did not see them as two different things, when they read that, they saw it as both. It's blessed are those who hunger and thirst for things to be right. They want things to be made right, to be put to right, for justice to be done. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of justice. God doesn't care about poverty. What books are you reading? Did God care about poverty in the book of Acts? Or were they taking up offerings to help with the poverty in Jerusalem? Does God care about the rich oppressing the poor? Have you read the book of James lately? From beginning to end, God cares about social justice. And if he cares, so should you, and so should I. What is the second great commandment? Love your neighbor as yourself. That means you have to do right for him. If you wouldn't want to be oppressed, then you shouldn't let him be oppressed either. What's the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love your neighbor as yourself. What do we do with these passages? We need to think through the implications. One of the things that is causing young people to drift away from the church is a perception that the church doesn't care about social issues. And Christianity begins to be viewed as irrelevant because it doesn't address prejudice, doesn't rebuke the white supremacists, doesn't care about the poor, doesn't care about the refugees. And they say, that doesn't make sense. They don't understand that. If God cares about those things, shouldn't we? And I think that one of the things we need to do if we want to keep our young people is not only give them answers for what the critics say, but to show that we care about people. And we want them to be treated with justice. So I'm saying all that because when I say trust the timing and character of God for the present and the future, that doesn't mean that we sit back and do nothing. As citizens of God's kingdom, we are to express the values and the character of that kingdom so that others will be drawn to that kingdom. And I'm sorry, I got to preaching and I'm out of time, so I'm just going to list these others. The third thing is rejoice in what we have. And oh, I wish we could, you meditated on it, will you, this afternoon? Verse 23 and 24, what do we have? The psalmist there, as he's gathered with the congregation, he remembers what we have as the people of God. We have God. Verse 23, the first part, we have His fellowship. Verse 23, the second part, we have security in His hands. In verse 24a, we have His guidance. And in verse 24b, we have an eternal hope. I wouldn't trade what I have in Him for all the wealth in the world. And I would rather suffer anything now than to miss out on these wonderful things that we have because we're the people of God. We have not cleansed our hearts in vain. So, in verse 26, my flesh and my what? Back to His heart. I know my heart's weak sometimes. I try to make it pure, but sometimes it gets discouraged. My flesh and my heart may fail. But God is the strength of my heart. I come to Him and see Him, who He is, and reflect on the relationship that I have with Him, the riches that I have found in Christ, and my heart is strengthened. He is my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. Their day will come. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. Take heart. Strengthen your heart in the Lord. You have not believed in Jesus Christ in vain, and your trust in God, the judge of all the earth, is not in vain. Purify your heart. Be strong in the Lord. The day will come when the oil and the water will be separated, and the character of God will be vindicated. Mark, will you come and lead us in a closing song?